This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
I'm going to do a couple of interesting things. The one is, we're going to examine the concept of masochism. Is masochism a symptom of a sickness? Or is there a middah of masochism? And like all middahs, of course, it can be misused. It can be used incorrectly. But is masochism something completely distorted and sick? Or is there such a place? Is there a place? Does it have some kind of source in a value, in a valued set of middahs? Secondly, I'm going to generally examine an area which I haven't previously done, which is the area of Yisurim, the Jewish attitude towards suffering. There's no way that we can complete it in one evening. It's something one will have to spend many shiurim on over the time, but at least we'll get an attitude towards it, the Jewish view to suffering. And one has to be very careful, because one can oversimplify the Jewish view to suffering and then it comes out incorrect. One can confuse it with the Christian view to suffering. One has to be very careful with the correct attitude to suffering. And thirdly, I'm going to tie up something I said last night, which was in connection with that, with suffering, with something that I said a week or two ago, which is the difficulty of educating a spoiled person. And you might already begin to see the thread and the connection between these things. Somebody put to me this week, explained the feeling that he has, which is a very valid and correct feeling. And that is, he says he comes to shiurim and he listens and he learns and he enjoys and he goes. But he doesn't feel that his being present makes any difference, or it would make any difference if he wasn't being present, that he doesn't feel a personal communication process. And his question was, is it necessary to feel a personal communication process? It doesn't matter. So he's coming into a big lecture hall, and he's listening, and he's learning, and he goes out. What's so terrible about that? Maybe that's how it should be, but he feels that that's not conducive to his learning. But in a shiur, he needs to feel personal communication. And I want to examine this a little bit, as well as a very simple question on the Sedra, which is the old question on which I've given many shiurim already, of what was the machlokes between Yeshua and Kalev on the one hand and the 10 spies on the other hand. Principally, what is interesting is that there is no dispute on the facts. Nobody says, never does Yeshua and Kalev deny any facts that are raised by the other 10 spies. Whatever they say they saw, the two agree is correct that they saw. So as far as reporting the facts are concerned, nobody is arguing that the 10 spies are not telling the truth. The argument is purely in one of interpretation. In fact, they weren't sent to make interpretations. They were sent just to come back and report facts. And had they stuck to that and come back and report facts, there would have been no problem. But they got involved in interpretation, which was beyond their area of competence. And it's in that area that the machlokes arose. It's in that area that the dispute arose. How to interpret what they saw in Eretz Yisrael. And we've got to understand what that machlokes was, what that dispute really revolves around. Chazal in the beginning of Bereshit, a string of strange chazals on the same subject, various midrashim that talk about the fact that when it says Vayare Elokim et kol asher asa, and the Ribbono Shel saw everything which he had created, Vehinei tov ma'od, and behold it was extremely good, it was very good, good in the superlative. And the Midrash has all sorts of funny comments on what that means, very good. Every other day it just said, and it was good, it was good, it was good. All of a sudden on Friday, Tov Ma'od, it was excellent. And one of the things that the Midrash says is, Tov Ma'od is Malach HaMavis, that was death. God created death on the sixth day. And that's what he felt made it all so excellent. That's what really was the cherry on the top. which is very difficult to understand. What does that mean? Goodness is something that one wants to experience. And goodness is not just something objective. What's good for one person is not good for another person. But the feeling of something good, experiencing goodness, can quickly come. The experience of goodness. Before we discuss even what goodness is, which in fact we're not really going to go into, what goodness is, what constitutes feeling good. What we're really going to go into this evening is what detracts from a feeling of goodness. Is it possible that you can be exposed to something good and not notice that it's good? Is it possible that you can experience that God can be showering goodness upon you and you don't feel the benefits of the goodness that He's giving to you? Is that possible? The answer is yes. Not only is it possible, but it's probable. And that's the area that I want to examine. What is it that makes it so difficult sometimes to note that you're in fact the recipient of goodness? There's really only one simple answer to that. And that is taking the goodness for granted. Now that's a cliche. And what we've got to do is now penetrate below the superficial meaning of that cliche. Of course, if you take something for granted, you don't appreciate it. In order for a thing to feel good, you must appreciate it. And when you take it for granted, you don't show that necessary appreciation. But what does that really mean? There are two things that you need in order to appreciate goodness. The one is you need contrast. Let me give you an example. You can be listening to a symphony of music, and it builds up, and it starts, and it starts with the violins, and then the cellos come in, and then the winds come in, and then the violas come in, and then the brass come in, and then the double bass comes in. Finally, you've got the whole orchestra playing, and it builds up to a massive crescendo, and the last note is a perfect pitch that they reach, and they give a blast on that note, and that ends the symphony. And you go away with this note ringing in your ears, and it's so beautiful. It's so incredibly beautiful. Because in that note, you can hear all those instruments wrapped up together. And not only do you hear all those instruments wrapped up together, but you actually hear the build-up of the whole symphony. Just in that one last note that you go away ringing in your ears, you've got the whole symphony in your head. But what would happen if you recorded that note and you just turned it on to play continuously? It would be an impossible noise. You wouldn't be able to take it. The note is only beautiful because of the contrast between that note and the note that came before it and the silence that came after it. Music is very beautiful, and if you break music down into its constituents, it is the appreciation of the contrast of different notes or different chords against one another and against silence. It's always that contrast. If the whole musical framework, if the whole span of time was filled with noise and there was no space of time in between each note, there would be no rhythm to it, there would be no interest to it. It would become boring, and in fact it would become a noise. It's necessary for there to be a rhythm, which is a specified time between notes. There must be periods of silence after every note, otherwise you don't appreciate the note. After every chord, after every musical concept, there has to be, even if it's a brief moment of silence, but if there isn't that silence, you can't appreciate the beauty of the note. And it can't then be followed with another note exactly the same as the one that you've just heard, and then another one exactly the same as the one you've just heard. You can do that two or three times, but then you need something outrageous to keep the attention of the listener. If one doesn't have variation, if one doesn't have contrast, it's impossible to appreciate the beauty. The first thing that we need here is an appreciation of contrast. If the sun always shone and it never got night, we wouldn't even have a word to describe day. There wouldn't be such a word as day. There wouldn't be such a concept as day. We wouldn't relate to the existence of daytime. It's only because there's nighttime that we had to find a word to describe day, and another word to describe night, and that we realize that day is something and night is something else. But if you only had daytime, if you only had sunlight, or you only had nighttime and you were never exposed to the opposite, we wouldn't have a word for it at all. It wouldn't be possible. If you couldn't hear at all, we wouldn't have a word for noise or a word for sound. If there was just silence all the time, you wouldn't have such a concept as sound. You wouldn't have such a concept as music, as speaking, as any of these things. It's only because we can be silent and there can be noise that you need a word both for silence and for noise. And because there can be two kinds of noise, that you need a word to describe each kind of noise so that you can appreciate the difference between them. And one of the most important constituents of beauty, and beauty and goodness are very closely related, one of the most important constituents of beauty is richness. And richness requires contrast. When there's a boring thing, as beautiful as it may be, you can have a beautiful color. An artist might be able to make a beautiful color blue, and as they do now, and they still call themselves artists, they just paint a whole board with this one beautiful color blue, and you're supposed to admire it. But if you just walk past it and you see it as you walk past, it's a nice color. But you can't stand and look at it for very long, it's not rich. You need a combination of elements playing off one against another. You need a combination of concepts, a combination of experiences to show up the contrast one for the other before you can fully appreciate them. I had a record of Rubinstein playing one of the Beethoven concertos, and it was very good, it was extremely good, and I played it about 50 times. And after you've played a record about 50 times, the record's just about worn out, it loses its quality. So I thought, before I say goodbye to my beloved records, I would play it once more. But this time, only after I've heard other people playing the same concerto. So I went and I took a whole lot of records out of the record library, all of them the same record. All of them a Beethoven concerto, which I was referring to, each one played by a different pianist. And I sat and I listened to all of them. And after listening to all of them, I put back my old, scratchy, beloved Rubinstein. Then one understands the godless. Then one understands the greatness. All of a sudden you realize that every pause that he makes, all of a sudden you realize every note that he plays, the volume of every note, each one is planned, each one is precise, each one is carefully worked out to have exactly the right effect. And you would never have realized that if you didn't have the contrast. You can have something beautiful in your hands, and you can know that it's beautiful, but not fully appreciate the richness and the depth of its beauty, simply because you haven't experienced the contrast. You've experienced only day, you've never had night. So the first thing one needs in order to appreciate something good is at least an imagination, but a very good imagination. At least the imagination of what things would be like if it weren't there. Without that, you can't appreciate anything good. So the first thing you need is to be able to walk out into the sunlight and stop for a moment and just ask yourself, what would it be like if God switched off the sun? Just to understand. It's not scientifically feasible. He's not likely to do it. But nevertheless, unless you're able to stop and imagine what it would be like if he did turn off the sun, there's no way that you can appreciate the sun. You're going to take it for granted. That's the first level of taking something for granted, when you cannot imagine the world without the thing which you are experiencing. We must lock the door now, ladies and gentlemen. Second type of taking for granted is more subtle. And pull out the phone as well, we're learning. The second form of taking something for granted, which is more subtle, is the taking it for granted in the sense that it's not there for me. You can be walking along Leoboth Avenue and you're very tired and you need a lift, and nobody stops for you, and you're hitching, and all of a sudden a big lorry comes past with a nice convenient sort of ledge to stand on at the back, and he's driving past slowly, and you jump on and you drive all the way up Leoboth Avenue into town, and you jump off again. You don't say thank you to the driver, he didn't even know you were on. You don't feel he did anything specially for you, he didn't. If you're particularly sensitive, if you're really a sensitive person, you'll say that was lucky. And if you're religious and sensitive, you'll say, Baruch Hashem, that van should have come past. Thank God. But nobody would think that, after all, the driver of the truck also did something for me. And the Chovas Havovas paskens that one is obligated to show appreciation, not only to somebody who did you good without him knowing, but even to somebody who did you good when he planned to do you evil. If a man plans to do you harm and it just turns out to your benefit, you still owe him a debt of gratitude. How much more so when he didn't plan to do you anything evil, he just did you a favor. But when one climbs onto the back of a wagon, you don't feel that it's for you at all. You don't feel obligated to the person who's driving the wagon. You don't feel that there's been any kind of personal relationship, whatever. As I say, if you're both religious and sensitive, you'll say Baruch Hashem. But Baruch the truck driver, nobody will say. And it's necessary to feel a personal relationship with the source of the goodness, and with the goodness itself, in order to really enjoy it. One of the reasons we don't enjoy the sunlight is because we go out and we don't imagine what the world will be like without the sunlight. But the other reason we don't enjoy the sunlight is because we go out and we say to ourselves, okay, but there is sunlight. And it's not here only for me. I'm just jumping on the back of the wagon. If I wasn't here, the sun would still be shining. I'm not so impertinent to think that God shines the sun for me. I know that the sun is shining in any event, and I'm just here. I just happen to be enjoying it, that's all. That's fine, all very nice and modest, but it doesn't give for a relationship, not between the Ribbono Shel Olam and the man, and not between the sunshine and the man. What's needed is the ability to imagine the thing not being there, and the ability to imagine that it's just for you. That's all. And for that one needs two things sometimes. The one thing that one needs is the existence of the opposite. So you need to know what darkness is in order to appreciate light. You need to know what an overcast day is like in order to appreciate a sunny day. That's the first thing one needs. The second thing is, one needs to see that not everybody gets the sunlight. If it's distributed out equally in a socialistic sort of fashion, there's no way that you can feel that it's specially for you. If you live in Russia and you get your food coupons the same as everybody else gets their food coupons, you don't feel that you're being paid for a job of work you've done, because everybody gets exactly the same. In order to acquire a sense of personal relationship with what you're doing, it's necessary that each employee is paid differently. To set standard scales of payment, if you're a manager you get so much, and if you're a director you get so much, and if you're a carpet sweeper you get so much, that ruins the personal relationship between the employee and the job of work he's doing. Because now he doesn't feel, I'm doing a job of work and I'm getting paid for it. But what he feels is, I'm a carpet sweeper and I'm being paid for it being a carpet sweeper, but I don't have to sweep carpets. Once I have the title of carpet sweeper, that's what I'm being paid for, because every carpet sweeper gets paid. And he doesn't feel the necessity to put love and care into his work in order to justify the payment which he's getting. So it's necessary that people be treated differently in order for a person to feel that what he's getting is specifically for him. When things are dished out equally, he doesn't have that feeling. We talked about spoiled people. What are spoiled people? Firstly, spoiling is not what most people think it is. One mustn't confuse spoiling with loving. One sometimes finds parents, with all respect to the German community, very often one finds such people among them, and among the Anglo-Saxon community, particularly the English community, where parents think that loving a child is spoiling a child. You mustn't confuse loving and spoiling. There's no way that love can spoil a person. You can give a person as much love as you want and as you can, and there's no way that that will spoil the person. What does spoil the person is doing things for him which he's perfectly capable of doing himself. Basically, giving him things for which he doesn't have to battle. That's spoiling a person. Removing from him the opportunity to feel that his reward is in reciprocation of his effort. And when a parent gives to a child before the child makes the effort, there's no way the child can appreciate that what he's getting is in reciprocation of something he's done. So you can have a child who's struggling to pick up his teddy bear and can't quite reach his teddy bear, so you go and you give him the teddy bear. So there's no way that he feels that he took the teddy bear. The teddy bear came to him. And that's his right, that the teddy bear must come to him when he wants the teddy bear. He doesn't even notice that the parent gave it to him. He just looks at the teddy bear and the teddy bear comes. You know, there's some children that you can carry around, and if they're very energetic, they'll point to what they want. And just with a point. And they expect it to come, and if they don't, they yell. But there are some less energetic children who just have to look, and then they get what they want. That's where the spoiling process starts, where the child has to make no effort to grasp that it comes and it's given to them. And don't think that the child is appreciative to the parent for helping him out. The child doesn't even know that the parent has done it. The child just thinks the teddy bear came by himself. The second way of spoiling a child, which is very closely tied up to the first way, of course, is treating all children the same. That's it. On the one hand, one has to be careful not to show favoritism. One can feel favoritism, but one's not permitted to show favoritism. But favoritism is where you when you consistently prefer one child to the other. That's no good. But one has to show differentiation, discrimination. There's a difference between discrimination and favoritism. Favoritism is when Yankel always gets the best, and all the others can just, it doesn't matter what happens to all the others. That's favoritism. But discrimination is sometimes Yankel gets the best and it doesn't matter what happens to the others, and sometimes Moshele gets the best, and sometimes Itzele gets the best, and sometimes Avremele gets the best. It just depends on what they've done for it. It's the ability of the parent to respond to the particular efforts put in by the particular child on the particular occasion. Normally it doesn't work like that at all. The mother comes with the food and puts the same amount of food in each child's plate. It's easier that way. The father comes with some toys and he gives each child a toy, each child a present. It's easier that way. Why start figuring out which child deserves it more and which child deserves which one? It's very difficult. It's emotionally difficult and it's intellectually difficult, and the tendency is just to treat them all the same. So one needs two principles. The one is not to do what the person is capable of doing himself, and the second thing is not to be indiscriminate in one's giving. One has to give in relation to what is given. In the Briel, in the world, the first thing that the Ribbono Shel Olam created was the contrast to life. There's no way that life could be called good, and what he created on Friday was life, human life, if there was no death. If life would be everlasting, if it was impossible to die, there wouldn't even be a word for life. Nobody would even know that there's such a concept as life. It would be taken totally for granted. So the first thing he had to do was make sure that the concept of death exists. The fact that it was extremely good, what added to the goodness now is that not only is it good in its essence, but mankind is capable of appreciating the goodness of life because there's a contrast. There's something they can compare it with, and therefore they can understand that life is real. The second thing, which is tied up with the Malach HaMoves, is to notice that not everybody gets the same life. Not everybody lives the same length. And the quality of life is not the same for everybody either. And with that, we have the creation of Yisurim. We have the creation of suffering. Because if there were no suffering, then we would have a socialist situation where lack of suffering would not be appreciated. You might say that's far-fetched. Who would not appreciate having an easy life? Who would not appreciate having a yacht in every port, a private Boeing 747, houses in every major capital of the world, as much money as one needs, be a Talmid Chochem at the same time, have a wonderful family? Who wouldn't appreciate such an existence? Imagine that the Ribbono Shel Olam gave it all to us. We all had that ability. I'll show you a little bit later that we wouldn't appreciate it. So the answer to the question that was raised is yes. It's very important to sit in a shir and to feel, number one, that you're in a shir and that there's a difference if you're there or you're not. And that is clear. But more than that, it's necessary to feel that there's a personal communication, that the shir is for you. If you weren't there, there wouldn't be a shir. The whole thing is just for you. And you might say that's arrogant, but we'll discuss that also in a minute. But now I want to go one step further, and in the light of what we've said, show you how to achieve this. And in this case, I'm going to challenge, in a sense, that which was said, that one needs that personal relationship. Yes, one does. And my challenge is not to the individual who raised it, because he knows the answer. It's to those who haven't raised it. Of course there has to be a personal relationship. And here I'm going to read to you a Gemara, which I've done with you before, but I'm going to read the first part of the Gemara now too. Haroye uchlusi Yisrael. If a person sees multitudes of Jews, Omer Baruch Chochom Harozim, then you've got to say a bracha. Say Baruch Ata Hashem Elokeinu Melech Ha'olam Chochom Harozim, Master of Secrets. It's an incredible bracha to say when you see masses. Why? She'ein datan doimezeh lezeh ve'ein partzufehim doimezeh lezeh. Because no two people among that whole multitude that you see have the same faces or the same opinions. And that you've got to compliment the Ribbono Shel Olam on being able to create a mass of people. Everyone is unique. Everyone looks different. Everyone thinks different. Everyone operates differently. So it's not to fall into the trap of relating to people on a mass basis. Baruch Chochom Harozim. Ben Zoyma Ro Uchlusu Agav Maile Baharabais. Ben Zoma saw a huge multitude of people. Later on they define what a multitude of people is, and it's over 600,000, so it's lots of people. And they were on a hill near the Har HaBayis, near the Beis HaMikdash. Omar, so he said, as one has to, Baruch Chacham HaRazim, blessed is he who is the wise master of secrets, Uvaruch Shebara Kol Eilu L'Sham Sheni, and blessed is God who created all these multitudes of people to serve me. That's what Ben Zoma said. Let's understand it a little bit more. Hu Haya Omer, he used to say, Kamo Yegiyas Yoga Odom Harishon Ad Shemotso Pas Lecho. Let's think of the world, he used to say to his Talmidim, as it was when Odom was the only man and he wanted a piece of bread. What did he have to do? Chorash, he had to plough. Vezorah, he had to sow. Vekotzar, and he had to reap. Veomar, and he had to put it into sheets. Vedash, and he had to winnow it. Vezorah, and he had to, another form of winnowing, uvorer, and then he had to select it, classify it. Vetochan, and he had to mill it. Vehirkid, velash, veofo, and eventually he could bake it. Vachatach ochal, and then he could eat his loaf of bread. Avalani, what do I do? Mashkim, I get up early in the morning, and I sit down at my table and there's bread on the table. It's all been done already. Who did it? It's all these people standing in front. Baruch Shebara Kol Eilu L'Sham Sheni. Blessed is God who created all the bakers among them and all the millers among them and all the people that are serving me. And if the Odom Arishon wanted a new suit, what did he have to do? Gozaz, he had to go and cut the wool. Velovan, and he had to bleach it. Venofat, and he had to beat it. Vetova, veorag, and he had to then weave it. Vachalkach motzo begid lilbush. And eventually, after days and days of work and toil, he had a piece of clothing to wear. Vani and I, mashki mumotze kalele musukonim lefonai. Want a suit? I go to a shop and I buy the suit. It's all been done for me already. Kol umois shokdois uvois lefesach besi. Vani mashki mumotze kol eilu lefana. Sorry, kol umonus shokdois uvois lefesach besi. All the different trades and professions, work and toil and trouble, and they bring their wares to my house. In those days, they used to have deliveries rather than supermarkets. Vani mashki mumotze kol eilu lefana. And I wake up and it's all there. What I need is there. Let's stop there for a moment before we go on to the next piece of Gemara which we've done previously. One sees an attitude of Ben Zoma. This Gemara, by the way, is in Brachas Daf Nun Ches Amud Aleph 58a. One sees an attitude here. An attitude which on the surface would be labeled as arrogance. What right has Ben Zoma got to go and see 600,000 people and look at them and survey them from end to end and take pleasure and say to the Ribbono Shel Olam, Baruch Shebara Kol Eilu L'Sham Sheni. Thank God for making all these people to work for me. And yet when one thinks a little bit more carefully, it's deeper than that. And the Gemara goes on to explain it. Hu Haya Omer, that's the same Ben Zoma that used to say the following. Oreach Toiv Mahu Omer. What does a good visitor say? Man who comes and eats at your table. If he's an Oreach Toiv, if he's a good visitor, what does he say? Kamo Tirchos Torach Balabayis Bishvi. Oh, look at the effort that the Balabais went for me. Look what he prepared. They laid the table. They put out knives and forks on the table. They put out glasses and plates on the table. They must have prepared food since goodness knows who went. They must have gone to buy the food. They must have brought it home, prepared it, had it all ready, put it out on the table, served it up. It's incredible. Kama bosor hevi lefanai, all the meat that he brought. Kama yayin hevi lefanai, the wine that he put before me. Kama gluskois hevi lefanai, all these nice tasting sweets that came afterwards. V'chol mashe torach le torach elo bishvili, it's the same line, Ben Zoma. And all this he just did for me? All that meat, all that wine, the table, the decoration of the whole room, the flowers on the table was just because I was coming for lunch? Aval oreach ra mahu emir. But what does a bad visitor say? Ma Torah. Torah, Torah, Baal HaBayis. What this trouble did this Balabais go to? At least I didn't put him out. He was very good to me, but I feel very good that I didn't put him out. I ate a piece of bread, one piece of wine, of meat. I drank one glass of wine. All the work that he did for his family. And I happened to be there. Clearly it wasn't a problem. That's, of course, reversed roles. What the Balabais has to say is, please don't worry, we would have had the same even if you weren't here. And the Oreach has to say, all this just because I was here? That's the same Benzema. So we see that it's necessary, in order to be an Oreach Toiv, in order to feel the goodness that has been given to one by one's Balabais, it's necessary to feel that it was all done specifically for you. Not only what you ate, but what everybody ate. And nobody would have got it if it wasn't for you. That he wouldn't have bought that good meat, and he wouldn't have put wine on the table, and there certainly wouldn't have been flowers on the table, and the whole thing was just done because you were there. If you weren't there, they would have eaten in the kitchen, they would have had a slice of bread, and a piece of cheese, and a cup of tea, and that would have been their meal. But because you were there, they put the whole thing out. That's how he has to feel. But on who is the obligation to feel that way? On the Oreach. The Oreach has to do that, and is described as an Oreach Toiv if he does, and an Oreach Ra if he doesn't. What does the Balabais do? Makes no difference. We're not talking about the Balabais here. That's a different discussion, how the Balabais is meant to behave. But even if the Balabais made him feel unwanted, and even if the Balabais rubbed into him that he's not doing anything for the visitor, it's all quite normal, this is the way they do it. And even if on the surface it looks as if it's really the way they do it, maybe the Oreach came, maybe the guest came, and they did eat in the kitchen. And maybe they did just have a slice of bread and a piece of and some butter on the bread and a cup of tea. Maybe that's what they dished up for supper. Still the Oreach is obliged to say, all that just for me. One sees an attitude in the recipient, an attitude in the Oreach, which has nothing to do with the attitude in the giver. So much so that when Ben Zoma stood on the Harabais, when he stood up by the Beis HaMikdash and he saw all these 600,000 people, he was able to say to the Ribbono Shel Olam, thank you for creating all these people to serve me. It's part of the same philosophy. He doesn't mean it arrogantly that they're all my servants, but he means all these wonderful people are working for me. I owe them a debt of gratitude, every one of those 600,000 people. I owe a debt of gratitude. Some of them took part in making my clothes. Some of them took part in making my food. Some of them took part in building my house. Some of them take part in cleaning the streets. But it's all mine. They clean my street. They built my house. They made my clothes. I don't care what they do for the rest of the world. I must feel as though if I weren't here, they would close shop. Everybody else is benefiting because they're doing it from me, not I'm benefiting because they're doing it for everybody. I've got to feel when that truck comes past and I jump onto it at Louisbeth Avenue, outside the Royal Cinema over here, and I go all the way up into town, I've got to feel that that driver came all the way from wherever he came to pick me up and take me into town and let me off. And the fact that there are a whole lot of Coca-Colas on it as well that happened to get to their destination. Well, the Coca-Cola company is very lucky that I happen to be going the same way as their truck was meant to be going. That's the attitude one has to adopt. And of course it's not true. Of course it's not real. But if one doesn't adopt that attitude, one's going to lose tremendous richness. One's not going to notice, because in fact it is true. But Ribbono Shel Olam did send that truck specifically to pick you up. Nothing is coincidental. And if the Ribbono Shel Olam sent the truck to pick you up, maybe the driver doesn't know it. But says Rabbeinu B'chaya in the Chovos HaVovos, you are still obliged to thank the driver for the lift, even if he didn't know that he gave you the lift, and certainly he didn't know that he was sent to pick you up. And one sees an attitude here. This is an attitude which is a Torah attitude. When one talks about Torah Midos, this is what one's talking about. That it makes no difference. The nature of the giving is unimportant to this exercise. There's an attitude of an Oreach. There's an attitude of the person who's receiving. And don't say, but I pay for it. He makes my clothes, but I paid it for him. He chose to do it. I didn't ask him to. That's an Oreach Ra. That's a bad visitor in this world. Not the kind of visitor that Ribbono Shel Olam enjoys entertaining. That's his job. One almost has to go, if one goes to a restaurant to have dinner, one finishes one's dinner at 9:30 or 10:00 and one walks out, one almost has to say to the waiter, I'm sorry for keeping you up so late. And he'll look at you as if you're meshuggah because there's still many other people, but that doesn't matter. He's been waiting for you. He's been serving you. The other people don't come into this relationship. If you want it to be a meaningful relationship between you and the waiter, If you want to feel something human and something real and not just somebody passing food backwards and forwards and money backwards and forwards in return, if you want to feel that it's real and human, you've got to make it human by feeling that he's doing it for you and for nobody else. And that if you weren't there, he would go home. It's not true, but that's how you've got to feel if you're going to be an Oreach Tov. But to go afterwards up to him and say, thank you for serving me. And he'll say, don't worry, sir, it's my job. That's how you're supposed to say it. That's a balabayit tov. That's what a good host has to say. But the big danger is if one gets oneself to the level of going up to the waiter afterwards and say, thank you very much for serving me. I'm sorry I kept you so late. And he says, don't worry, sir, that's my job. If you say good evening and you walk out and you forget, then you've fallen for it. You're back to the Oreach Ra. You should still go out with a feeling of guilt. Yes, that's what he says. But maybe that's not his job. Maybe he stayed extra late because there were lots of people in the restaurant and I was one of those lots. Maybe he has a family waiting at home. Okay, maybe he'll be paid overtime, but maybe he wouldn't have chosen to be paid overtime. Maybe it's more important for him to get home. One has to actually go out with a little feeling of guilt, a little worry and concern. Maybe I did hold him back. Then it becomes real. Then it becomes personal. And the fact that money is passing backwards and forwards in return doesn't matter. It's not just a business transaction. It's an interhuman transaction. And the whole tragedy of the lives in which we live is that it's tit for tat. I'm paying you to do it, so what does it bother you? I don't owe you anything in return. I'm paying you. Everything is fair exchange. Nothing for nothing. That's all very good in a business. But it removes the human element completely. You can have robots exchanging things backwards and forwards. You don't need human beings. And we've got to fight and battle to make relationships meaningful and to keep relationships human. And the way they have to be done is that the recipient of the relationship has to feel as if it was done for him. When a tailor makes you a suit of clothes, or you buy it from downtown, it makes no difference. Your relationship to the man who served you, to the man who gave it to you, or to the man who owns the place, has to be as if you didn't pay him. Well, sure, you paid him. You've got to pay him, otherwise it would be theft. But that doesn't mean you don't owe him a debt of gratitude. That doesn't mean you haven't benefited from him. That doesn't mean he hasn't done something for you. And not only must one feel that he's done something for you, but one must feel if it weren't for you, he wouldn't even be in the business. His whole business is just that you should be served. There's the delightful story. I don't know whether it comes from a Gemara or a Medrash or where it comes from. It's about somebody who asked what the purpose of various creations were, and he couldn't quite understand why certain things were created altogether. And then the scene switches to a crazy man who builds a castle in a desert, and he entertains lots of guests there. And the whole story develops and builds about the magnificence of this castle. He used to have crazy ideas like Gatsby a little bit. Imagine Gatsby out in the desert. He had a Monsieur Gatsby about entertaining people in his home. And one evening he had a whole crowd of guests and the food was all laid out and something happened, everybody was poisoned, everybody died, and that was the end of it. And a long time later, meanwhile, let's say the food was covered with sand or whatever it was and was preserved, and many, many years later, a poor old Jew straggling along the way, lost, hungry, thirsty, tired, walks into the desert and there's a castle. He walks inside and he finds his food and his drink, and you know how the story ends. The point being, there again, one has to walk into that castle. Here it's obvious. The man walks into this castle in the desert, and he knows that the Ribbono Shel Olam has put it there for him. But one must be in that situation all the time. As one goes around, you go and you post a letter. Just imagine, at the time of posting the letter, that the international postal network, the whole world, has been established for you to be able to send mail backwards and forwards. Creates a different relationship with the postman, creates a different relationship with the post office. And next time you're standing in a queue in the post office and you want to swear that the man is standing on the other side of the bench because he's taking a little bit longer than it suits you, just realize it's all there for you. Take it easy. He'll get round to you too. One has to understand when one picks up a telephone, one gets frustrated when one picks up a telephone, but you've got to think of the intricacy of what goes on behind that telephone and figure that it's all been designed for you. From the day of Mr. Bell until the present day, all that technological development was just that you could put through a call. That's it. Don't look at it on the basis of it's a service I'm paying for and it's not good enough. I'm not getting my value. That's an Oreach Ra. That's not an Oreach Tov. And we are Orchim in this world. We are here at the Ribbono Shel Olam's pleasure He's put us here for a temporary period as visitors, and we have to subscribe to the concept of an oreach tov, of a good visitor.
What was the dispute between the 10 spies and the 2 spies, Kalev and Yehoshua? Very simple.
The 10 spies come along and they must have had a terrible impression. You know what it is, sometimes a person wants to emigrate. And they decide they'll go on a short visit first just to see what the place looks like. So they decide they'll go to Canada. Off they go to Toronto. They're very silly about the way they set about it. And they go in the winter and it's miserable. And nobody's in the streets, and those that are cold and miserable and dressed up like anything and sneezing and coughing. And the cars are all stuck and nothing works and everything's in a mess. He comes back and says, let's stay here. It's an awful place. Had he just gone at another time of the year, it would have been a nice place. One's initial impression of a place is so important. If you have a bad experience in a place, some people go to Israel and they come back, fantastic, wonderful. Some people come back and they say, not for me, I wouldn't be seen there. It just depends on the personal experiences you have. If you come out of the airport and a taxi man comes up to you and says, where are you from? South Africa. Please let me take you. And you say, sorry, I can't afford a taxi. He says, then you won't pay me. What is it, a Jew? I'll do you a favor. Get in my car. Where do you have to go? Then you'll come back and you'll say, Israel is wonderful. It can happen such a thing. But if you get into the taxi and you say it's to Jerusalem, and you say how much, and he says 250 liras, and you say, fine, you get in, it's late, and you're tired. And you get to Jerusalem and you give him 250 liras, he says, and the rest? It's 250 liras. That was for your suitcase. Well, for you. You know, what are you going to do? Fight with the taxi driver, so you pay him the other 250 liras, but you don't go back to Israel. What does it depend on? On little experiences, on superficial things that don't really matter, but they create one's impression. Let's imagine how we would have reacted in the position of the 10 spies. Off they go to this wonderful promised land. A land flowing with milk and honey, where everything is just going to be beautiful, and everything's going to operate smoothly, and everything's going to be wonderful. And they find the people are unpleasant. They find they treat them like grasshoppers. That means they walk over them and stamp over them. Familiar. Sounds very familiar for that part of the world. That's how it is. They treat them really badly. They take them for a ride. They're strong. They're overbearing. They're powerful. And yet people are dying all over the place. People are sick. They're diseased. Our place is chaotic. It's degenerate, immoral. It's Canaan, the very center of immorality. And these are unkadoshim. This is a holy people who's just received the Torah. Is this where we're going to live? Okay, they figured the Ribbono Shel Olam thinks we can handle it. We don't think we can handle it. That's all. We would rather stay in the desert or go back to Egypt, where we live an isolated life and we don't handle this, have to handle this kind of degeneracy and don't have to fight with this kind of physical handicap and difficulty, and moral and spiritual handicap and difficulty. We would rather sit in the desert.
What do Yehoshua and Kalev say?
Vayomru. And they said, I'll call Adat B'nai Yisrael Emo, to all the people of Israel, saying, Ha'aretz asher avarnu ba'alaturota, this land which we went through to spy it out, tova ha'aretz, the land is good, ma'oid ma'oid, and it uses the same word twice as is used in Bereshis, when Chazal tells us that means malach ha'moves. Of course people were dying over there, of course the place was full of death, but after all God himself calls that goodness. What does it mean? Says the Netziv, it means that it's a wonderful, wonderful place, because if you step out of line, God hits you in Eretz Yisrael. The rest of the world, the Hashgocha, God's relationship to the individual is not that tentative. You can be naughty a little bit and it takes a long time before he hits you. But Eretz Yisrael, he's watching carefully all the time. And one step out and you get hammered. And that, you might say, is not a land where I would like to live. Say the two meraglim, but that's what makes it so beautiful. Because it's the only land in the world where you can appreciate goodness. Number one, you see it's not handed out indiscriminately. You see there are people who suffer in Eretz Israel. There's terrible suffering there, much more than in other lands. There's hardship, there's difficulty. But that means when you get a good deal, you appreciate it. When you get an honest taxi driver, is that a mechaya? Is that good? Here we take it for granted. There it's something that not everybody is zoche to get. Sometimes you get one, sometimes you don't. When you get one, you appreciate it. If you live well, if you're able to live and you manage to able to make ends meet, and you're healthy and your children are healthy, and you don't, chas v'shalom, need to resort to the mercies of the kupat cholim, so you appreciate it. And if you don't appreciate it, then the Ribbono Shel Olam just sticks a little bit of problem in the home. Just one kid starts coughing a little bit,
and you go and spend the day in Kopat Chulin, and then for the rest of the year you appreciate it again, what it is to have health, what it is not to resort to a doctor. But do we know what health means? I'm not talking about serious disease. Just the difference between being healthy and having a little bit of a disturbance. No, because what do? We call the doctor and he comes and gives us something and the disturbance goes, it's nothing. Having flu in Johannesburg is not a handicap. It's not terribly serious. It can be overcome. It's not a problem. There's a doctor who's waiting and you don't even owe him anything because you pay him and off he goes and that's fine. That's an oreach ra. That's somebody who doesn't appreciate the good things because the bad things he's even taken for granted. We'll come to that in one moment. Therefore, say the Meraglim Eretz Yisrael is wonderful. Number one, you see it's not handed out indiscriminately. And number two, if you move off center, you get hit. And therefore, it's Tovah Haaretz Ma'od Ma'od. It's particularly good because there's a mechanism which keeps you in the position where you're able to enjoy the goodness. You don't become degenerate. You wouldn't have to become degenerate. On the contrary, it's easy to remain morally refined because you get hit when you move out. And on the other hand, one sees the contrast and understands the goodness of it all. That says the Netziv is the meaning of Hine Haaretz Tovah Haaretz Ma'od Ma'od. The land is extremely good. I just want to look briefly at two other aspects of Yisurin. What do we find? Because the Gemara says in Shabbos, Ein Yisurin Beloi Ovan. The Ribbono Shel Olam doesn't bring suffering if you don't deserve it. You've done something wrong. If you're suffering, you've done something wrong. So Yisurin becomes a message. Yisurin becomes something which redirects you, which shows you that you're slightly off the mark and that you just need to get back onto course. So Yisurin number one is direct communication. Pain and suffering is a feeling that Chaim Moshe Grudzinski calls it a form of nevuah, a form of prophecy. It's direct communication from the Ribbono Shel Olam to yourself. It means that God cares about you, He's worried about the way you're going, and He's prepared to take the time and energy to tell you that you're doing it wrong. That's what Yisurin is. Yisurin enables us to appreciate goodness. Because number one, it gives us the contrast, and number two, we see that goodness is not indiscriminate. So when one has a little bit of pain and suffering, when one has a little bit of problem, one has to take joy in it, in a sense. Here comes the role of the masochism. One takes joy in two areas, and this is where one has to be so terribly careful to define the masochism correctly, otherwise it becomes Christian. The joy is not in the pain. The joy is in the increased quality of the goodness. That's what it is. There's no pleasure in being sore. But at the moment that you're sore, you've got to be overcome with joy of the goodness. When a person is ill, chas v'sholom, he's got to take pleasure in good health. Not look bitterly and jealously on people who have good health, but take pleasure, satisfaction, have fun in the knowledge of the value of good health, something which he isn't normally aware of, he doesn't normally know. So yes, there's a sort of a masochism because when they are yisurim, one's ability to appreciate the good is intensified, but then one has to direct one's view onto the good and not onto the yisurim. And secondly, God's communicating. There's a direct relationship between the Ribbono Shel Olam and ourselves. And that's the essence of not being spoilt. Yisurim is unfortunately the only way of solving the problems of a spoiled person. There's no other way, unfortunately. Normal systems of education don't work. Because what does a spoiled person do? He's the oreach ra. He's the person who whatever you give him takes it for granted. He doesn't understand that you could be without it, and he doesn't understand that not everybody gets it. He thinks everybody gets it, and he can't imagine that anybody could be without it, or that it's not indiscriminate. And one finds usually that the response of the spoiled person is to start becoming difficult, and the response of the other, of the giver, is to give him still more. And the more difficult it becomes, the more they give, and the more they give, the more difficult it becomes, and the person is totally ruined and spoiled. That's the end of it. The tendency to pander to what people want, not to what people need. Chesed is to give people what they need. Spoiling is to give them what they want. And it's your job as the giver to decide whether they need it or whether they want it. Sometimes a want and a need is the same. But that one has to think out very carefully before one responds. The danger here is the danger of taking Yisurim for granted. Now you might think that's far-fetched. Taking suffering for granted. Because of course if you take suffering for granted, again you miss the whole point. The whole point is to notice it and respond to it. But there's a tendency to take suffering for granted. I'll show you a Yerushalmi,
which is in Berachos, the 9th chapter, the 5th Mishnah, which is the well-known story, but the intricate details of it are not so well-known. Rabbi Akiva Havakayim Mitadun Kumi Tonostropus Harosha. Rabbi Akiva was standing in judgment in front of the wicked Roman general, who was in fact busy killing him. Rochtas Onoso de Kriyashma. The time for Kriyashma came. While he was standing there, it was Man Kriyashma. It was an afternoon, let's say, and Mincha time had passed, Nidavan Mincha, and now it was time to Davan Ma'ariv. It was time to say Kriyashma. Shari Kari Kriyashma. So he stopped and said Kriyashma, the Gochach, and in the middle he burst out laughing. And firstly, the time of saying Kriyashma is quite a serious time of the day. But when you're busy dying, it's particularly serious. And here's Rabbi Akiva saying Kriyashma on his deathbed and laughing. We talk about masochism. Amarle, so he said to him, the wicked general said to him, Saba, old man, Icherishata imivat biyisurinat. Either you're mad, or you're just taking pleasure in pain. And in which case you're sick. So you're either mad or you're sick. Amarle, so he said to him, Loi charash ana veloi mivat biyisurinat. I'm neither mad, nor am I taking for granted or pleasure in Yisurin. And then he goes on to tell the famous story that it says, after Hashem Elokecha b'chol levavcha, with all your heart, that I could do. B'chol me'odecha, with all your money, that I could do. But b'chol nafshecha, to give your life for the Torah, I've never been able to do. All of a sudden I realize, you wicked general, that you've given me the opportunity to do a mitzvah, and I owe you a thank you. Right? You've got a situation like this, where Rabbi Akiva is in fact being killed by the general, and he owes something. He bothers to go into communication to tell the general that in fact you're doing me a favor, you're enabling me to perform a very valuable mitzvah which I could never have done without you. And it's at that pleasure that I'm laughing. The point that I want to bring from here is not the story of itself, which has many points to it, but the fact that Rabbi Akiva found it necessary to deny the accusation of the wicked general that he was taking his pain too lightly, says Rabbi Akiva Ona. That means it would be wrong to take one's pain too lightly. One mustn't say that it's a Jewish value to become insensitive to suffering. And say, oh, well, that's the way the Ribbono Shel Olam wants it, and I go on, that's it, finished. That not. One has to be sensitive to suffering. Now you'll say, how can one become insensitive to suffering? And Chas v'Shalom, one can be living a wonderful life, and all of a sudden one loses all one's money, one loses all one's family, like Eeyore of Nebuch. Is it possible to be insensitive? You're hurt, you're sore, you feel it. That's why pain works with a spoiled person, because that's the only thing he responds to. When you give him, it's like the teddy bear. He thinks the teddy bear is coming, and that's his right. He doesn't respond. He doesn't notice that you're giving him anything. When you hurt him, he responds. That you're not supposed to do. That's not playing the game with a spoiled person. That's against the rules. And he responds. And even if he responds violently, at least you've got a response out of him. It's worth a violent response just to get him moving, to get him functioning. You'll say, how do we take pain for granted? There's a story brought in the Torah Kohanim, in the Chukosai, I think, where Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha says, we were sitting once, a colleague and I, on a bench in the park under a tree, and we were talking in Torah. And all of a sudden the wind came and the branches started making a noise, and we ran, because we thought there was somebody in the tree trying to get us. And forget, they lived in anti-Semitic surroundings, and if you heard funny noises behind you, two rabbis sitting on a park bench hearing funny noises behind them, they got scared, they went off and they ran. They got to shelter away from the tree, and they looked back and saw that it was nothing, it was just a wind. So what would we do? We would laugh and go back and sit down. They cried. They said, that's the klala, that's the curse, that you will be chased, v'rodaf eschem olei nidaf, that the ruach, olei nidaf, I think the words are. You will be frightened, you will be chased by the noise of a leaf just blowing in the wind. You're going to be so scared out of your wits. They realized this was a klala. They realized this was a curse, that they were being punished, that this terrible curse which the Ribbono Shel Olam mentions in the Torah was now applying to them. We wouldn't be sensitive to that. We wouldn't call that suffering. We wouldn't notice it. So the Ribbono Shel Olam would have to turn the screws on still a little bit harder for us, because we wouldn't notice that kind of suffering. I gave the example in the shiur the other morning. Jews go around this country very proud of the fact that they run the place. Well, they used to, even recently.
They're in everything. The Jews are in politics, the Jews are in big business, and everywhere where you look where there's a successful business venture, there's a Jew over there. Wonderful, wonderful. What a brocha, the affluent Jews of South Africa. And I sit back and I look and I say, who really owns the place? Sanlam, and Santam, and General Mining, and Union Corporation, and Anglo-American. They own the place. Not a Jew anywhere in sight. Not one of them is anything Jewish. It's amazing how the big corporations that really do own the place aren't in any way Jewish. So what are the Jews doing? They're the managers for the Goyim. They're running the place for the Goyim. So you might say, but what's so bad about that if they get paid well? Well, number one, it's not as they thought it was that they own the place. They don't own the place. They're workers. They're employees. Number two, that's a klolo in the Gemara again. It's a curse. The Gemara says, Bizman she'emosin ritzayin ha'shul makun. When the Jews do the will of the Ribbono shel Olam, and other people do their work. They earn shares, and the shares do well, and they sit and learn all day, no problem. And the dividends come pouring in. But when they're not fulfilling the will of the Ribbono shel Olam, they do the work for the others. The goyim sit in the golf course and at the Rand Club, and their shares bring in the dividends, and it's the Jews who are slaving. It's a klolo, it's a curse, it's not a bracha. And the sickness is that we don't notice it. The sickness is that we don't notice it's a cursed situation. Golus. We're in a situation of golus. Do any of us lie awake that we're in golus? I'm not talking about the fact even that we're not in Eretz Yisrael. But we're in golus that we don't have a base of mikdash. Come Tisha B'Av, we try and extract the tear out of our eyes, which is very difficult, and mostly we don't even manage that. And once Tisha B'Av is over, it's forgotten again. Do any of us feel that we're being pinched by the fact that we don't have a Mashiach? Do any of us feel that we're suffering because we're in Golus, because we don't have a Beis HaMikdash? We're insensitive. We take suffering for granted. This is perhaps the biggest tragedy of mankind. To take goodness for granted, that's bad enough. But when we start taking suffering for granted, we close the doors of communication between the Ribbono Shel Olam and ourselves. You can have a person who comes into a Shir late, and you don't have to say anything to him because you know he's suffering. Came in and you know that he's going through a miserable time. And to say anything to him would be terribly cruel. So you don't say anything. You have another person you know comes into a shir late and you know he's not suffering at all. So you say something to him. You have another person who you know is not suffering at all and it won't even help saying anything to him. Even when you say something to him, he won't feel upset, he won't feel sore. He becomes immune to it. And that's the worst thing. That means you can't communicate with him. That means you have to go and bash him. It means you have to physically hurt him. He's just lost all human sensitivity. When a human being loses the ability to be hurt subtly, when a human being is not sensitive enough to be hurt in a delicate way, he starts creating barriers that makes communication with him, even by the Ribbono Shel Olam, virtually impossible. Says the Gemara in Erchin, what is Tzar? Where does Yusurim start? Chas v'sholom, going bankrupt, I understand that's Yisurim. Losing a dear one, that's Yisurim. But where does it start? How little does a thing have to be before you can call it Yisurim? Says the Gemara, this is in Erchin 16b, if you put your hand into your pocket to pick out 3 cents and you come out with only 2 cents and you have to put your hand back in your pocket a second time to take out the other cent, that's Yisurim. That's the Ribbono Shel Olam trying to tell you that something's not in order. We don't call that Yisurim, we don't even notice. We don't expect to pull out 3 cents when you put your hand in. We're used to the Yisurim. That's like the person that comes into the shir late and doesn't even help shout anything. Completely insensitive. You've got to do something much more drastic. And the equivalent would be to drive to one's work place of work or to drive home in the morning or the evening and not get all the traffic lights. That's Yisurim. Shouldn't be necessary. You should. The Ribbono Shel Olam can organize that you get all the traffic lights. To be put to the inconvenience of not getting all the traffic lights is already Yisurim. Means you're not thinking what you should think while you're driving. You're not using your time correctly, so what's the point in saving you a bit of extra time? It's a message. Getting caught in a traffic jam Erev Shabbos. These are all messages on not only Erev Shabbos, any time of the day. Anything which the Ribbono Shel Olam puts a little stumbling block in front of us, one has to know that's the beginning of Yisurim. That we're insensitive to it. And so on.